Welcome to the Wealth Matters Podcast, where investors come together to better understand how to build passive cash flow and create generational wealth without all the confusing mumbo-jumbo. Here's your host and co-author of Amazon number one bestseller, Alpesh Pamar.
Welcome to Wealth Matters Podcast. Today's guest is Travis Bauckham, the founder and CEO of Balcomi Capital. Balcomi Capital is a boutique firm for high net worth and high income individuals that specializes in a seldomly invested but well-known property type that performs better than most others. And we'll, of course, talk about that as well. So welcome, Travis.
Hey, how are you doing, Alpesh? Thanks for having me on.
Good. How are you?
Doing well.
So we are going to talk about, of course, what you do, as well as we want to focus on how you get access to off-market properties. But before then, I always ask this question to all my guests. Tell us something interesting or funny about yourself.
Yeah, that's you're going to have my brain spinning here. But yeah, I would say interesting or funny about myself. Some of the more easier ones, right? You know, I got four kiddos and a wife, live in Central Texas. We try to get out of here about 1 or 2 months out of the year collectively on vacations. We go to not too far from where you're at, out up in the mountains of the Sierra Nevadas. We love that.
Yeah.
something funny about myself. Yeah, man, I can't think of anything, to be honest with you. On the spot here. I don't know you too well. What do you think? But yeah, I'm notorious at making dad jokes and
Jail well.
Yeah.
My kids keep telling me you're so bad.
Which is the greatest. Like it's okay when they laugh, but it's even better when they're like, that was so
bad. I don't get it. Yeah. But I'm like, I'm instantaneous. I got some good sense of humor. That's what matters, right?
Sure, for sure.
So let's talk about investment, because this is a building wealth show. What was your first investment and how did it work out for you?
My first real investment was, I was a huge back in 2006 or maybe even younger, or maybe 2005. I found Dave Ramsey and I put $3,000 into an IRA, which it's really important that I sent $3,000 into an IRA in 2006, because nothing ever happened to it. Like it never went up or down. It just kind of stayed there until 2012. And I took it out and I decided to defer the penalty of paying my Roth IRA. And I used that money to help buy my first house.
Wow,
nice. So I bought my first house in 2012. And the down payment was that money that just kind of sat there in the market for, almost 10 years, or I guess, 8 years, 6 years, somewhere around there. And I was like, this ain't working. And it's going to take a long time to get wealthy, to get free, to get financially free, where we can live the life we want to. This is me telling my wife this at the dinner table. And I'm like, I want to take this money and put it in a HUD home, a foreclosed home that was owned by the housing of or the HUD, owned by HUD. And so, I would say my first real investment was actually buying that house, because that's the one where life started going really well for me.
That's awesome. So, and what kind of assets do you invest in now?
So, historically from 2012 to 2018, and even pushing that to like 2020, we were only buying houses and multifamily. That would be primarily like Class C houses, Class B rental property. We were flipping houses, workforce housing, houses that could be afforded by almost everybody. That was kind of my hedge to like getting stuck with a house. I wanted to be able to buy a house, renovate it, and sell it. And the government's always, even in a recession, the government's always trying to make sure that average home buyers, so the teacher, the vice president, that sort of thing, can buy those houses. So we were always trying to buy that price point of home. So like now that would probably be 400 below, but at the time it was like 225 and below. We accumulated around 72 rental houses. And then I realized I didn't want to, in October 2018, I realized that wasn't going to get me where I wanted to get. Kind of like the Roth IRA didn't get me. It wasn't going to get me where I wanted. I'm like, I like this. I've done well. We've been able to buy some houses, do really well, live a nicer lifestyle. But to get to that next level, the what I would call the, like, take 6 months off and have a business rant run for you by really smart people, that level, we're going to have to change assets. And so 3 years ago, we started buying self-storage facilities.
That's perfect.
And we haven't got to that take 6 months off level yet, but we're certainly, last year was our first year to take 2 months off and we've had some really great experiences, me and my family do, because of making that decision.
That's awesome. So let's talk about off-market deals. What are off-market deals? How do you define?
Yeah, I would say off-market deals. I would define those as deals that are not currently on an easily accessible, collected website or, MLS or service.
Crexie, LoopNet.
Yeah. Crexie, LoopNet. Those, I think there can be deals found there. Most guys that do what I do think that's just where deals go to die. But I would say it's a good place to meet people that know where the deals are. So it's a good place to meet brokers, et cetera, that can go, hey, I get this one deal that, this guy doesn't want to pay a commission, but he might want to sell. I think it's a little price high, so I don't want to list it, sort of thing. That's actually how we found our first five self-storage facilities. And we were looking as a broker was like, hey, you probably won't want to buy this one because your criteria is too expensive, but we have this other one that we're talking to this gentleman. He's slow. He doesn't want to pay us a commission, but hey, like if you close on it, just give me like 20 grand and we'll call it good. And so I ended up going directly to that guy and, in about 3 months I was able to close on that deal. But that's how I define what off-market deals are, the ones that the majority of the populace doesn't have access or know how to get access to.
So that's a great point, doesn't have access, right? So how do you access off-market properties or opportunities?
Well, I would say before you just find the buildings, find the real estate, you really got to make sure you're a people person, because the people selling these things, it's been... unless they're like in a really stressed out situation, it's been their baby for 10, 15, right. 20, 30 years. It's been the way they put food on their table. And so they don't want a hotshot coming and just like, popping off saying, we can do this, we can buy it here. But, they don't want anyone to talk quickly to them, at least in the self-storage industry. They want to take someone out to lunch. They want their wife to come. They want to vet you. They want to make sure you're not some sort of scumbag. They want to make sure their manager or their employees that they're about to give to you are also going to be taken care of. They took care of that employee for 10 years. That employee took care of them by running their facility really well. Now they're going to, expect you to do the same. They want to make sure that lady's not going to get fired on day one, that sort of thing. So the way I access them Texas is a big state. I drive a lot. We drive to get to different facilities. On my way to facilities, I'll see another facility. I'll call the number because there's a good chance that number in storage facilities, at least that's a good, especially in rural towns, there's a good chance that that number is actually the owner that's going to be picking up, or the manager who's like related to the owner or knows the owner or something like that. Or you just stop in at the manager's office. We've had one in Burnett, Texas, which we ended up not buying, but I ended up stopping at every office I thought was the actual office because it was like the number was disconnected. And then there was a building right next to it that was the same color as the facility. I'm like, that's got to be. And that was like, no, we're like a nonprofit with the church. I'm like, okay, sorry, they're like, we just called this one number. And it was like, it was a San Francisco number, actually. And so I called them and no one picked up. So I went to another location and we ended up not buying it because someone wanted to pay a lot more than we wanted to pay for it, but because I was the only one trying to track down the owner, apparently. But that's really it. It just takes a little bit of hustle. That we used to do the same thing with houses. Like we'd knock on the door, say, hey, we're interested in buying, or we'd write the address down, go home, send them a handwritten letter. That worked pretty well too with houses. I would say with storage, there's a whole lot less, and it's a lot easier to see them. And it's really hard to automate a lot of that stuff with storage because of the way the postal codes work. Each asset class or each type of postal address has a certain type of class to it. Like multifamily has a class, houses have a class, and the storage class gets kind of muddled in there with cold storage and distribution centers. So unless you want to also own cold storage and distribution centers, you're probably going to be combing through a pretty big list of pieces of real estate or addresses, trying to make sure you're getting what you want. And so Yeah, that's how we do it. We just try to be people and try to make friends. And if we get to buy the facility in exchange of that, that's just obviously the bonus. That's the goal. But it's also, we don't want to ever leave anyone thinking that we're jerks or punks or anything like that.
So it's a great point where you said that you're driving a lot and you see a property. Or how do someone like me, who is sitting in San Francisco, but of course do not want to invest in California, how can someone find off-market properties which are out of state? And also, how do you build rapport in that case with the seller or broker?
That's a good and challenging question. The easiest response would be you could partner with someone like me.
Exactly. That's where I was going.
Okay, good. The other thing is you can get the letters out to them. You're gonna probably have a 60% reach rate on that. And then at that point the letters just have to be really warm and comforting. Maybe have a picture of you and your family as opposed to just like your company's name, that sort of thing.
And I get those kind of letters as well myself.
Yeah, and I've actually, on Friday, I actually got some lady, you could tell it was a VA, a virtual assistant, called me and they're like, are you interested in selling this facility? I'm like, first off, maybe. Second off, how did you get my number? I got to figure out how someone else is besting me on my business here. This is a great idea.
No, I get tons of letters and as well as phone calls as well and through VAs, right?
Yeah. What do you own? Like what type of assets do you own?
So yes, I have, of course, single family, some left, about couple, and then small multifamily, which I directly own. But then I'm partner on a lot of large assets, including a lot of mobile home parks, senior housing facilities, and a couple of self storage as well.
Nice. Right on.
So, yeah. And I believe in mobile home park and self storage facilities. So those are some of the best investments you can make right now.
Super low operational, especially when you only own the pad and it's city water and city sewer.
Exactly.
Mobile home parks and storage facilities really have the lowest operating costs.
And storage really is even easier. No 3Ts, right? No tenant, termite, and toilets.
That's right.
So let me ask you this. Is there any time constraint for when you find an off-market deal? Like you have to turn around really fast to the broker or seller because it's an off-market deal and someone else may jump on it as well?
I think it really depends. So I know the gentleman I bought my first five facilities from, he had already gotten an offer from Marcus and Millichap, a broker from Marcus and Millichap.
Right.
I didn't find out until almost a year after I bought it what that offer was. It happened to be a lot less than what I paid for it.
Right.
But that's my best facility. I'd pay what I paid for it again immediately. Once you get it under contract, you can buy yourself some time so you can have a 30-day window of feasibility, then a 30-day closing, and then normally you can like extend it even more with like an additional 15-day. But after that 30 days, your earnest money will be hard, meaning that if you don't close, the seller is going to get your cash. And that's just, you know, that's kind of, in my opinion, at that point, that's when you're like, I'm getting this deal done. So even on some, we've had some that the bank calls us 7 days before we're supposed to close. And they're like, we need you to bring another $600,000 to this deal because of this and this and this regulatory matter. And I'm like, well, dude, it's like freaking Christmas. Like, how am I going to do that? Like, you know, like, and so you have to call all the people that you know, that could help you out in a pickle and get it done. But yeah, it's it gets serious there. I would say once it's under contract, you're probably fine. So if there's a lot of hurry up and waiting, you know, you got to make sure the revenue's there. You can prove the revenue, you can prove the operating expenses, or at least you know what the operating expenses are going to run based off of other facilities that you own. And then you want to you want to lock it up as fast as possible. Like so that deal I was telling you about in Burnett, Texas, like one of the things I like to do is mountain bike, and there's a mountain bike park right around the corner.
Oh, okay.
I have to pass that every time I go to that mountain bike park. I have to pass that facility, and every time I do, I'm like, that's the one that got away. And like, it's doing a great. I'm like, I don't think I could have paid while it was falling apart. It was a joke of a facility, but like, you know, I still I'm still pretty upset I missed out on it, you know, just because. But the thing is, the hard thing is I've been passing about it for like 6 months. I'm like, they got to sell that. They got to sell that. And then when I called, someone else had an offer. But if I would have just called the first time I saw it, then chances are I could have got it without having to worry about I would have gotten a better interest rate because this is last year.
Yes, you know, like this, of course. This is last year.
I could have got it locked up in 2021 as opposed to 2022. And the people that bought it weren't around anymore. It wouldn't have been around until another 6 months. So yeah, I would say you got to act pretty quick in the sense of like, once you find a deal, you need to lock it up because deals, the great thing about deals, they come around as fast as the train comes back around. Yeah. But at the same time, like you gotta act on it when you know it. Like if you're a tiger in your little territory and you see a bunny rabbit, you better jump on that thing before another tiger gets it. So.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, does the due diligence or underwriting differ because of it's an off-market deal?
It's not any harder. The seller, the thing is, in the feasibility, when you're in the due diligence period, you're kind of calling the shots. Like you can back out, and all you have is the loss of your time. So like if you're asking the seller for, I need taxes, my bank needs the taxes, your taxes the last 2 years, I need the rent roll. I need, you know, I need your utility statements. I need to know who's late. I need to know who's, which units are vacant. You know, if they're not giving you that information, you're increasing your risk every day. So like if they're, unless you just know that you can turn it around and you're getting it for a good price, then you really need to get that stuff. If they don't provide it, there's some reason why. And that reason could be because they just don't have it. It could be because they're trying to hide something from you and, you know, sucker you into a deal. And so I would say that have a 30-day feasibility period to make sure that you can get your money back. Receive the contract at a title company, which is a really professional organization that will give you your money back. Don't give it to him personally. And then, you know, if he doesn't get that stuff to you, like there's like most promulgated contracts in states, show that or give you the ability to get out of the contract because they didn't provide these things within a certain amount of days. I wouldn't say the due diligence or the underwriting differs. I would just say that it might be a little harder to get it because the guy might be, we bought a facility in Oklahoma City. The guy was a land developer. And so sometimes we just couldn't get him on the phone. When I say he's a land developer, he wasn't a guy wearing a suit, like drawing the photos. He was actually moving the caterpillar, like the dirt loader, dirt movers and stuff like that. So like he'd work, like he was one of the hardest workers I've ever met. You know, he'd be up at six, working till six, and then he'd call you and be like, oh yeah, let me get my wife to get that to you because I don't know where it's at. And this is a $6 million purchase that we're buying, you know? But like sometimes you can't even get them on the phone, and it's not that they're trying to hide it from you. That's just their life is busy. And so they're not going to get to you. But if you're offering a lot of money and they're really wanting to sell, they're probably really excited about getting a big, huge sum of money. So they should be getting you that stuff. So if they're not giving you the items that you've asked for, then, you know, there's probably a good reason why you need to back out.
Which markets do you operate in now and why?
Primarily Texas. I really like, if there's an issue, I like to drive to my facility and check it out, make sure it's still there, make sure the management company, we have a remote management company and we have a facilities manager that only shows up once a week unless there's an emergency or something like that. And so I like to drive, make sure the grass is being cut, make sure there's not the trash. I want to make sure it looks good. It looks presentable. We do have one in Oklahoma. I have a partner that lives 20 minutes away from that facility. One of the reasons I brought him on is because I wanted to make sure that someone was there when we needed them to. And that's worked out really well. If we were to buy stuff outside of Texas, I would, which I'm open to and would like to, I would make sure that we have a person of trust within a short ways away to, you know, because, you know, the Oklahoma, about a month. So on March 31st, Oklahoma had a bunch of grass fires. And one of our buildings from the embers, one of the buildings caught on fire. I'm like, man, if it wasn't for my partner, I would have had to leave on a Friday, fly up there, stay at a hotel, and figure it out. But my partner was able to do that, and we were just able to talk on the phone. I got to spend the weekend with my family. And so that's kind of why we do that. We just always want someone around so they can go and kick the facility and make sure it's not going to fall down.
I agree. So let's talk about numbers. What has been your best self-storage deal so far?
Yeah, I would say it's our first facility. We bought it for $2 million. It was making 200-ish thousand a year in revenue. And it was the only facility in that market. And I felt like we could at least get it to the Texas average, which was $65 for a 10x10. And it was at 40. I was like, wow. So I was like, surely we can get to 50. I think we can get to 65. Well, the first year we had to 67.
So
I would say within 10 months, we got it to $67. Like basically, it was performing at $5 or $6 a square foot annually, depending on which side, the size and which size of the unit. And another thing that was cool is that gentleman, I don't know why, but he had monitored security. He was paying $3,000 a month for someone to look at a screen and make sure no one stole anything. We still own that facility. It's been 2 years and we've had one issue, and we just like pulled the tapes, gave it to the cops. The guy filed his, you know, we forced place insurance through Safelease, like, you know, like the tenant insurance. And he like submitted a claim, got $2,000, which I don't think he had $2,000 worth of stuff in there. The cops got the tape, arrested the guy. And that was it. So like literally like less than 25 minutes worth of my manager's time. And this gentleman, when we bought it, he was paying $3,000
a month
to look at it. So $36,000 a year.
Right.
Our facility only bringing in $220,000 a year.
Wow.
I was like, so 13, 14% of the expenses.
Yeah,
so I'm like, I'm cutting that out. And so I cut that out. And then like within the first 3 months, we did a 20% across the board of 396 units, across the board increase. A lot of people upset, 7% moved out. So it went from 100% to 93%. I was like, okay, well, stabilized.
Still making the same amount of money.
Yeah, stabilized facility is 85 to 90%, right. And I'm at 93%. Let's see how this goes. So like 3 months later, I raised it again 20%. And that time we went to 85%. I'm like, all right, we're good. And then I did a marketing campaign, and then we forced placed insurance. And that's how we get that at 67%. And yeah, I mean, it fluctuates 83-87%. But that sucker brings in close to $30,000 a month when it was bringing in $19,000 a month when I bought it.
Nice.
And the expenses are like, the expenses last year, including my assistant, were $96,000. And so like we took a $2 million facility and had a six cap, made it a $4 million facility within 12 months.
Nice.
That's probably my funnest one. And we're working on a refinance on that guy right now. It's kind of hard because of do I want to take a 5% note and go to 8%, but at 8, I can give my partners their money back. You know,
it's interesting stuff, going through the same thing with our mobile home park. Cause we bought it for, 1.6, we put in another 1.6, but it's worth like 4.5 now.
Nice.
And we want to, you know, return the capital to our investors as well. And we are going through the refinance, and I'm like, it's 8.5%.
Yeah. And that's the stuff you don't really ever think
that's
going to slow down the economy. Like, we can't get our investors' money back. We're going to have trouble getting the next deal done.
Exactly.
And,
yes.
And you know, that's just going to slow transactions down, and everything's going to slow down. And then, you know, hopefully they'll lower some rates before it just gets made again. But yeah, that's that one. And the one we're working on right now, it's a ground up facility in Austin, Texas. It's 1,000 units. So it's huge. It's an institutional grade, best in class. I'm sure a public or private REIT will buy it. But that one, we're raising the money on that one right now. And it'll be, you know, next level for me. It'll be really, there's probably $18 million cost, $31 million valuation. We're looking at, you know, $12, $13 million worth of equity there that we can eventually sell and capitalize on. So
what has been your worst deal so far?
Wearsteel is actually was a house. There was actually several houses that were the worst deals. And that's why I wanted to move on. I'm like, I hate these, like, because we were primarily we purchase, renovate, sell. I like to purchase something and it has
more
revenue
flipping.
Coming.
Yeah,
more flipping. Yeah. So I would say it was my fifth and sixth deal, and both of them were in Dallas, Texas. The fifth deal, we bought a house and we're like, we can add a second story to this for $250,000. Well, it cost $470,000 to add that second story. And then we were like, we can sell this for $950,000, and we sold it for $715,000. So our cost basis was $828,000. Our sales price, not what we netted, was $715,000. The $715,000, you had real estate commissions, title, taxes, title fees. So it ended up being a $228,000 loss. It was my fifth deal to do in 2014. It was painful. And then the deal right after that was also in that same town, but it was in a kind of a it was in a neighborhood that had a lot of certain type of individuals live there, and they were incredibly pretentious. And we were fixing stuff up, and the guy got angry. He yelled at me a few times. He was a paralegal. What ended up happening is after a while, he ended up putting a mechanics lien for $150,000 on the facility. Didn't do any work. Completely fraudulent. So we were like, it sold for $400,000. We were in it for $300,000. He put $150,000 mechanics lien. We were all of a sudden upside down. And I was so embarrassed. I was trying to figure out how to sell it to these people that wanted to buy it for $400,000. But I'm like, I can't write an $80,000 check, which was like $50,000 plus the commissions. Right. And so we ended up having to sue that guy. He hired an attorney. So there's two lawyers. And then the buyers who had moved into as my tenants, the buyers hired an attorney. There's three attorneys. Nice. And I think the buyer's broker had an attorney involved too. So there's four attorneys involved on this stupid house because this guy next door was upset that one of his plants got broken. It was like a 14-month. It was like every day at 11:50 he would send me an email, 11:50 p.m. And it was just like I couldn't sleep after that because he was so scary. Like I was brand new at the business. I didn't know what I was doing. And I'm like, please. I was thinking I was going to go to jail because it turns out I ended up winning. I ended up winning the lawsuit. I won $29,000. Actually, collected $29,000 from him.
And the
sweet people that had moved in, they got to close and have some peace of mind finally. And this guy, I mean, the thing is, and we started researching it. It realized the neighbor was a shakeup artist. He had done that like four or five times to several other people. And I'm like, this guy just needs to accidentally get hit by a car or something.
This is great. This is great. Thank you so much for sharing a lot of golden nuggets. Are you ready for fire round?
Sure.
Would you be changing any business or investment strategy because of inflation or the upcoming recession?
We are focusing on good value add purchases as opposed to just purchases that will naturally go up through inflation. The typical syndication models, you purchase it, you reposition it, you refinance it, and then you sell it, or maybe sell it before you refinance it. We are eliminating the sales side of things. We're just communicating to our investors that, hey, we're going to buy this, we're going to build this, we're going to reposition it, we're going to refinance to get your money back, and then you're going to have an annuity for the rest of your life. And if someone like offers us a crazy amount of money, we'll sell, but we're going to keep it. If not.
Got it. No, I think that's interesting. Favorite investment or real estate book?
Yeah, I would say Margin of Safety. It's not a real estate book.
Okay.
Margin of Safety is a book by Seth Klarman. It's no longer in print. You have to buy a digital version and take it to the UPS store to print it so you can actually read it. There are some copies on Amazon that they'll go for $1,200 to $1,800 a piece.
Okay.
It's I don't know a lot of investment bankers, but I go, hey, what do you, I met an investment banker, I go, hey, what do you think of the book Margin of Safety? He goes, it's the Bible. It's the Bible for investment banking. So there's three parts. The third part is really all that incredible, like high end, like I have no idea what you're saying type investment analysis for stock brokering. But the first two are really about like fundamentals of investing, like make sure that you're not going to lose money. Like you should, if your number one goal should be, I'm not going to lose my investment.
Right.
If you lose your investment, you have to take an incredibly risky position to make it even to get back to where you were.
Right.
And now you're still break even. And then you have to do that. So The whole number one goal is to make sure you don't lose your investment or your principal balance, and then make sure that your investment is for the most part secured or guaranteed, meaning that instead of being like, well, I think I'd make 15% on this, you're like, well, you might make 15%, but this guy will give you a debt fund at 6%, or you can invest in this debt fund that will actually pay 6 to 8%. And you're like, well, that's, even though I have to pay taxes on that, I'm going to get something. And when I, after I pay taxes, I'll be left with a 5 or 6% return. So there's a lot of thoughts like that. And the way I interpret that, the way I use that book is, when I'm looking at buying stuff, I want to make sure that it's such a solid deal that I'm not going to have to start over if it, it's not going to go bad. I'm going to, because if deals go bad, that can actually eliminate you from being a real estate developer.
Right. So, no, and every deal you got to think of this, right? And
right.
I totally agree. I'll have to check the book out, right? And my mentors and my friends, when I started investing, they told me that the one rule of investment is don't lose your principal. Right.
Yeah.
So it's very important to remember. Any tool or website you recommend or you cannot live without?
It's not really a website, but I would say I really got into quantum physics on how to think about things and how to attract things to me, and Stoic philosophy. Both of those things have been really empowering to me. I would consider those are more mental tools, I guess, but that's how I would answer that one.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'll have to look it up. Any advice for beginner investors?
Yeah, we've kind of, both of us have kind of talked back and forth, but make sure you don't lose your principal. Don't get excited about the deal. Get excited about the safety in the deal. When you're looking at a deal, you're like, all right, I can make $100,000. You're like, okay, you can, but how much can you lose? My loss is I think the reason why crypto investors primarily were non-married men under the age of 30 is because they were so excited about the ego win, right? Winning the big deal so that you can brag at the club, or winning the big deal so you can impress all your friends or buy the Lamborghini. I would say do the opposite of that. Make sure that what you're investing in has sound fundamentals, has years and years and years of slow, boring returns, but consistent returns. I would shy people away from trying to make big money by flipping real estate, buying and fixing up, selling it, basically what I did for a long time. I made enough to support my family, but there was also a lot of really challenging times. Sometimes we weren't even able to pay ourselves. So we had a staff of five. They got paid, but we didn't. So that's what I would just say, stick to fundamentals, stick to one asset class. And then if you find a deal in another asset class that you don't know what you're doing in, find someone who is an expert in that asset class and partner with them. That's how I would approach that one.
That's awesome. How do you give back?
Well, my wife started a school 4 years ago with a big econ business focus and like a STEAM curriculum focus. So like science, technology, electrical, or engineering, art, and math. Sorry, kind of butchered that one. So, and she spends all her time doing that. It's never gotten paid. We've never gotten paid. And that's just kind of the way, that's kind of more of the philanthropy side of what we do. All of our kids go there. We started it in part because for my son, he's a very bright kiddo, but all of our kids are incredibly bright. They're really good at certain aspects of education and independently from each other.
Well, that's awesome. How can my listeners reach out to you?
Yeah, so the best way would be go to the website investinstoragedeals.com and scroll to the bottom and fill out your information. We are not going to spam you. We won't sell your stuff. We'll just send you our deals and send you, other tidbits on how to make money, how to grow your wealth, that sort of thing.
That's awesome. Thank you, Travis, for your time today.
Yeah, thank you, Alpesh. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Wealth Matters podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so others can enjoy the show too. Have a great week and happy investing!